This past December, I visited my mom and dad and little brother in Beaver Creek, Ohio, where I was raised from age 13 until when I graduated from high school. Beaver Creek is where I learned to drive a gold minivan with a dent in the side. It's where I learned to love Buffy the Vampire Slayer and how to pass chemistry tests. And it's also the random Ohio suburb where John Crawford III, a young black man, picked up a toy gun off a shelf in Walmart, held it harmlessly in his hand as he talked on the phone, and was shot and killed by police. It's where those officers were cleared of any wrongdoing, where students occupied the police department in response, and where the struggle for humanity, justice, and healing is being lived out as it is all over this nation. You know about this struggle. My guess is that as Unitarian Universalists, you've been raising your voices in song and in prayer, going deep into what the struggle for justice looks like in Ferguson, New York, Oakland, Cleveland, Boston, West Roxbury. What it looks like in every city and suburb, in the streets and courthouses, corner stores, classrooms. When I went back to Beaver Creek in December, I went to a vigil, one that's been held every week since John Crawford III was shot in the pet aisle, 0.36 seconds after the cops asked him to drop his gun, which was a toy gun sold in Walmart, not a gun. I learned that it takes 0.5 seconds for a quarter to fall to the ground from about waist height. A complete human blink takes 0.3 or 0.4 seconds. I read in the paper that John Crawford III was shot because he disobeyed police commands, because he didn't drop the gun, that toy gun that was not a gun. Take a moment. Blink. Imagine that you are on the phone with a loved one, in the pets aisle, distracted by weird dog toys and the newest cat food, 0.36 seconds, and someone yells, "Drop a gun," and you don't even have a gun. John Crawford took one blink. He was a black, unarmed man in 2014, and he died. That vigil was small and cold. I saw members of my childhood congregation, Miami Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. A few people honked their horns supportively. Others rolled down their windows, risking a blast of frigid air to yell, "Go home!" I wanted to yell, "I am home. I'm home for Christmas," in a country where people are dying from racism. The owner of a local bookstore brought by scalding coffee and cider and handed out cookies. We stamped our feet, and though I'm no great singer, I learned a song. Which side are you on, my people? Which side are you on? Martin King was a freedom fighter, and he taught us how to fight. We're gonna fight all day and night until we make it right. After being raised up in Beaver Creek, I've come to serve our movement as a Unitarian Universalist community minister. I spend part of my time supporting youth-led social justice work with a nonprofit called Boston Mobilization. Part of my time working for the Unitarian Universalist Association. At Boston Mobilization, youth of high school age come together across difference to do education, community organizing, to facilitate workshops on things like race, class, gender, to lead legislative meetings, to plan creative actions. We work across these differences. We're from Lexington and Boston, Brookline and Medford. We're black, white, Asian, Latino, Latina. We're Jewish, Muslim, Jehovah's Witness, UU, Hindu, Buddhist. Last spring, we were working on raising the minimum wage in this state, and we gathered more than 200 youth and adults, including many UU religious professionals of color who were in town for our annual retreat. We held a press conference next to the State House, and Deborah, one of the youth staff, a senior at Medford High School, talked about working at Dunkin' Donuts and giving her check to her mom to help out paying with groceries. She realized one week that she was giving her money to help pay for groceries, but many of her coworkers at Dunkin' Donuts were raising their families on checks, not just helping out with food money. Kate, another youth staff member who goes to Milton Academy, talked about being embarrassed about how big her house was, how she feared having friends over, worried that they would judge her or her family for their wealth. For Deborah, raising the minimum wage was about her family's ability to buy food, her coworkers' ability to pay for rent. For Kate, her relationships, her friendships, called her to raise the minimum wage as part of a larger picture of creating a more just world. Which side are we on, my people? Which side are we on? These past months, my job has been to keep running workshops on things like race and class, to keep going as business as usual, to keep the website up and the snack cupboard full. And it's also been a time when business has felt nothing like usual. When this winter's non-indictment verdicts in the cases of Michael Brown and Eric Garner's death have felt like that question, which side are we on, my people? Teens I work with who 9 months ago had never been to a protest, who did not have the words to talk about race or racism, now find themselves facilitating community dialogues with police officers, planning direct actions, organizing their peers, planning walkouts of hundreds. They're asking, which side are you on, as Mary, 15, African-American, offers a handshake to a white cop at the end of a long night in the streets, asking, which side are you on, outside of the State House, passing out the National Ferguson Action Demands? Agnew and his fellow activists going to the White House asking, which side are you on? I've been taught, as someone who was raised Unitarian Universalist, that we are on the side of freedom, that we stood on the side of love, on the side for freedom for women's right to vote and the abolition of slavery, that we were for desegregation and climate justice, for marriage equality and human rights, that the arc of the moral universe that you, of all people, know bends towards justice, and that when we are doing love's work, when we are on the side of justice, we will know. I was taught that when we're on the freedom side, some deep stillness or great awe will show itself, and we will know that this is the work of love and transformation. And here is a thing about justice and faith, which you may well know also. We never quite know which side we're on. We can never be absolutely sure that we are on the freedom side. There is no assurance that what we do is righteous. We may try, we may have the best intentions, and we may go to that small vigil, but we never know, was that the right thing? Or was it better to have spent our time at the State House or with our families? Those abolitionists, those suffragettes, those who worked for marriage equality in this state, there were also moments when they didn't know if that was the absolutely right thing. Moments when they disagreed, when they fought, when they traveled that road between doubt and certainty. Sometimes we're taught to forget how hard it is, this work of justice making. We've been taught sometimes that if it feels hard, if it's contentious, or if people disagree, then maybe it's not right. I see this happening now sometimes. I see this now sometimes when we forget that behind every act of righteousness, every march that is so perfect in the photos, there is a whole world of disagreement and complication. I see this in our conversations about how we make change, how we work for freedom. On Christmas Eve, back in Beaver Creek, I went to the mall across the street from the Walmart where Crawford lost his life in the blink of an eye. About 70 of us gathered to chant and sing and say the names of unarmed black and brown people who had died at the hands of police. The police came, doing their jobs, jobs that ask of them sacrifice and risk. And as we sang, the police escorted us out of the mall. They arrested a dozen on Christmas Eve, targeting the leaders, including a UU who I grew up with, who was in the youth group with. People said, "Why did you need to protest on Christmas Eve? Isn't there a better way?" I heard this here in Boston some months ago when protesters blockaded Interstate 93. I heard, "I agree with the cause, but isn't there a better way?" UU worship leader Matt Meyer put it this way when he posted about the 93 blockade on Facebook. He said, "If I had concerns about how smart of a tactic the I-93 blockade was, you won't see me put them on Facebook, because it was a better action for racial justice than what I was doing with my Thursday morning, which was nothing." He said, "If I someday plan an action that is just as courageous and risky and well-coordinated and that is also more effective, then maybe I'll be in a place to critique others. Until then," he said, "I'm filled with gratitude for the activists who are stepping away from their normal business to lift up the demands of the people of Ferguson and all those who say that Black Lives Matter." Layla Ibrahim is a Unitarian Universalist religious educator in Oakland, California. She writes that we are not in church to be with the people who sing the same music or rally for the same cause or attend the same retreats. We are in church to learn to love better. She says there is really only one choice between imperfect community and no community. Again and again, we are called to choose to commit ourselves to building a more just, more diverse, yet ever messy, ever imperfect, beloved community. One summer, we ended our youth program by going around in a circle, and each person was supposed to turn to the person next to them and say, "My liberation depends on your liberation." We were youth and adults, straight and queer and trans and cis and black and white and Asian and multiracial, and I was terrified that we wouldn't do it. That instead of learning to love better, we would walk away looking for a place where we could sing the same music, rally for the same cause, and not deal with the complexity of difference. I was scared that this brilliant group of social justice makers would find it impossible to declare that their liberation was bound up in the liberation of someone else, someone who maybe they had hurt or who had hurt them over the course of the summer. I was scared that it would be too imperfect, that it was asking too much, that we were too messy. There is really only one choice between imperfect community and no community. For one moment in that circle, we chose imperfect community. We declared that we depended on each other, that our liberation was bound up in each other's. There is really only one choice between an imperfect movement for justice and no movement for justice. In the imperfect movement for justice, we don't always agree. Sometimes we are mean and we criticize each other and we doubt each other's tactics and we undermine each other's leadership. But we try, oh God, we try to be on the freedom side. In a letter from Birmingham Jail written to his fellow religious leaders, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King wrote, "You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins and marches and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path?" King's words, "You are quite right in calling for negotiation. Indeed, this is the very purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such a tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks so to dramatize the issue so that it can no longer be ignored." King's words, "We who engage in nonviolent direct action are not the creators of tension. We merely bring to the surface the hidden tension that is already alive. We bring it out in the open where it can be seen and dealt with." Some of these amazing youth leaders that I work with planned an action a while back that disrupted a speech of the then Governor Deval Patrick with the goal of continuing to focus on the lives that have been lost to racism and violence. As he began to speak in what was a very celebratory, somewhat fancy gathering, their young voices rose up with the words of activist Asada Shakur, "It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains." Reverend Rebecca Parker, Unitarian Universalist theologian, says that love, as I and many religious progressives understand it, is dangerous. We advocate for love that surprises, disrupts, and alters the status quo, that expresses itself in diverse ways. This past Friday, as we came up upon the week that holds Earth Day, I found myself at Harvard, where I went to seminary, helping to continue the blockade of Massachusetts Hall, where activists have kept the administrators of Harvard from working for the past week as part of a movement to ask Harvard to divest from fossil fuels. I happened to arrive just as Cornel West was speaking about the intersections between racial and environmental justice. "Ecological catastrophe," he said, "is as evil as white supremacist catastrophe. We now have a planetary Selma." Divestment banners hung from windows. "Whose side are you on?" they asked. "Which side are we on, my people? Which side are we on?" Agnew said that only time will tell whether the stories of Renisha, Tamir, Mike, Eric, John, Ayana, and others will shape the course of history in policy, practice, or culture. And tragically, since he said those words, we now add names like Walter Scott, Tony Robinson, Jesse Hernandez, to the list of unarmed black and brown people who've been killed by police. Similarly, only time will tell whether these 2015 days will be the ones where institutions and individuals looked out on this great earth, looked out on the inevitability of climate change and said, "We may not be able to fix this totally. We have come too far for that. But we will do what we can to be on the freedom side." Which side are we on, my people? Which side are we on? We must answer that question with the faithful actions of our lives. Amen. And blessed be.